Welcome back. Today we start looking into horizons and singularities. So we will look into, we start by considering the causal structure in space-times. Can you read this from the back? Okay, great. Remember that the metric describes the shape, the curvature of a space-time. But not only that, as part of describing the shape, it's also describing the causal structure. See, if it's a Riemannian manifold that's just ordinary curvature, then that's all that the metric describes. But on a space-time, that is to say on a Lorentzian manifold, there is also the light cones. There's also the distinction between future infinity, past infinity, and space-like separated. And the metric describes all of that. Because the metric describes or can be used to tell whether a particular tangent vector is either light-like, its length is zero, or it's time-like, when its length squared is negative, and it's space-like if the length squared is positive. So the metric also decides and describes what is causal and what is not. By the way, I should perhaps clarify what is meant by the word causal in general relativity. Causal means either light-like or time-like, because causal influences can travel either at the speed of light or less. So anything that's not space-like is called causal. So for example, you could say I'm traveling on something is traveling on a light-like trajectory or on a time-like trajectory, or you could say it's a causal trajectory, which means it's either time-like or light-like. Okay, so the metric describes not just visually what we can think of as the curvature of a space-time, it also describes implicitly what is causality, how causality works on that space-time. Now let us consider an arbitrary point on the manifold, let's call it P, and then we can define a convex normal neighborhood or a convex geodesic neighborhood. That is to say, a set of points for which it is true that for any two points out of that set, there exists just a one unique geodesic connecting these points. Obviously, if you make a region too large, then there could be two different geodesics that start at the same point and end at the same point. But a convex normal neighborhood is, to a point, is a neighborhood in which any two events are connected by just exactly one geodesic. Oh, why is this open? Okay, now there's a lemma that says that there always exists such a neighborhood on a space-time. Now, let's consider a space-time. Let's say X is standing here schematically for some spatial part of some coordinate system, and T is the time variable. Then schematically, we can talk of the past of an event P. So because we haven't chosen the coordinate system in any particular way, the light-like curves can look a little curved here. So here's the event P, and then all these events that are in this backward cone, this backward light cone, because these are, by definition, lines that light could travel, everything that's in that backward light cone had a chance of affecting that event P. Anything that's outside, any event outside, cannot have had an influence on P, because nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, so therefore from here or from there, nothing can influence the event P. And then we say that the laws of nature are locally causal and therefore reasonable and therefore expected to, I mean, that therefore they can occur as part of our repertoire of laws of nature. if their equations of motion are mathematically such that what happens at that event P can be calculated from knowledge of only what happens on one of those space-like hypersurfaces in the past that are within that light cone. This is not trivial. This is not what Newton would have thought, because according to Newton, there is no maximum speed, and therefore, in order to predict what happens at an event here, according to Newton, you would need, potentially, you would need to know what happened anywhere in the universe. Because from anywhere, there could have been an arbitrarily fast signal traveling there and affecting P. But because of relativity, we know that actually the set of events that can have had an influence on P is restricted to the inside of the, to the past light cone and its inside. Yeah, and in Newton's theory, that wouldn't be the case because there C is infinity. An equivalent statement is to say that the laws of nature are locally causal if signals can be sent between events Q and P only if there is a curve gamma from Q to P which is non-space-like, meaning causal. Right? Everything is non-space-like, it's at a time or light-like, and therefore it's called causal. So we expect that the laws of nature are such that signals between two events, Q and P, can only be sent if the path between them, which doesn't necessarily have to be a geodesic, has tangent vectors, gamma dot, which have always negative length squared. So they are always negative or vanishing, so they're causal. So causality is super important because it decides, you know, if let's say there, that's where a murder happens, then anybody's outside there is automatically has an alibi, right? So causality is super important in relativity. And we can then ask, so if the metric describes causality, so given the metric, we can tell what the causal structure is. Because given the metric, we can tell which vectors are null, which vectors are light-like. And therefore, given the metric, we can tell what is inside, what is outside the light cone. And therefore, we can tell in which direction inferences can happen, namely time-like, light-like, and in which directions they cannot, assuming that we have reasonable, that is to say, causal laws of nature. But we can turn the question around. And instead of asking, instead of saying, okay, given the metric, I can infer the causal structure of the manifold, I can draw light cones, is also the reverse true. Imagine I'm given a space-time manifold, and I'm told at every point of the manifold where the light cones are, the forward light cone and the backward light cone. Can I then infer from that what the metric is? Right? It's clear that if I have the metric, I can draw the light cones. But if I only can draw the light cones, can I infer from that what the metric is? It would seem to be a little unlikely, right? Because if you only know where the light cones are, then all you know is in which directions, which tangent vectors have length zero. But is that sufficient to calculate the metric between any two tangent vectors? It turns out almost, up to one free parameter at every point. So here's the theorem. The theorem is this. Assume that on a differentiable manifold, we do not know the metric. So we cannot evaluate g of psi and eta. Psi and eta are two arbitrary tangent vectors, but that's what we want, right? So we don't have that. But assume that at every point in the manifold, we know, for some reason, we know whether a tangent vector psi is space-like, light-like, or time-like. So let's say we can tell at every point in the manifold where the light cones are, where the light cone is, right? The forward light cone and the backward light cone. So let's assume we know the sign of the length of the vector. In fact, we only need to know really when it is zero. Then the theorem says that, well, if you can tell at every point of the manifold whether a given vector is null or not, so if you can tell where the light cone is, then this information alone determines the metric already up to a conformal prefactor. That is to say, if we have some oracle that we can query, we can give it a tangent vector and it will tell us positive length, negative length, zero. If we have such an oracle that tells us for every point of the manifold whether a given vector is null or not, then from that information we can reconstruct g mu nu of x up to what is called a conformal prefactor, which is a scalar function multiplying the metric tensor. And we'll prove that. Now, why is it called a conformal factor? Well, it's for the following reason. Remember that, oh, there's a little space. Remember that if you have two vectors, A and B, and you calculate their dot product, then what that is the length of A times the length of B times the cosine of the angle between A and B. Right? And the metric is generalizing that dot product to an indefinite signature. But it's still, in principle, the same thing. And here what we have is the equation that the cosine of the angle between two tangent vectors is equal to psi eta inner product divided by that. This is the same as that formula. You just multiply that equation by the square root. Then you have here length of psi squared, I mean the square root of that, and then length of the eta vector, and then times the cosine is equal to the dot product of psi and eta, the dot product being evaluated using the metric now. Of course, these g's can be negative, and so we can get weird angles. These are not necessarily real valued. They could be imaginary valued angles. But that's how general relativity and special relativity work. So the angle between two tangent vectors, psi and eta, be it real or imaginary, that angle is given by that ratio. Right? We just take that equation and we divide by the length of A and the length of B. And then what we see is that there's a metric in the numerator, and then there is the square root of metric times metric. So if you take the metric and you multiply it with a prefactor that's scalar, C of x, then you have that C of x in the numerator, and you have it here and there. But you take the square root of it, so overall it cancels out. Therefore, if you take a metric and you multiply it with some scalar prefactor, it doesn't really affect the angle between vectors. It affects the length of the vectors, obviously, but it doesn't affect the angle between them. And in particular, it doesn't affect whether vectors are time-like, space-like, or not, because this is a positive prefactor here, and so, you know, whatever the length is, it will get larger or smaller, but it cannot flip sign, it cannot go to zero. Okay, so angles are preserved under conformal transformations, and in particular, the space-like and time-like and null nature of vectors is also preserved. Now, we want to prove this. We want to prove that it is true that if you only know the causal structure on a space-time manifold, you can already infer the metric. See, this is something that is completely different from a Riemannian manifold. On a Riemannian manifold, you don't have a causal structure. There's nothing propagating. It's just space, no time. So there is no causal structure to start with. And so there is nothing analogous to knowing the causal structure allows you to infer the metric. But on the Lorentzian manifold, we have this. Let's see how that works. Why would that be true? So here we start with the proof. For that, let's consider choosing a time-like tangent vector xi and choosing a space-like tangent vector eta arbitrarily at the point. So we choose at a point a time-like tangent vector and a space-like tangent vector. The length of this vector is negative, and the length squared of this vector is negative, the length squared of that vector is positive. And then we consider the linear combination of those two tangent vectors, where lambda is some real coefficient. Then let's ask, is it possible to choose lambda, to choose this number lambda in such a way that xi plus lambda eta is light-like, is a vector that has length 0? Well, yes, of course, because if we choose lambda equal to 0, then it's just xi whose length is, because the time length, is, length squared is negative. If we make lambda enormously large, then the eta is the only thing that matters. This doesn't really contribute much. And so therefore, now we have the space-like vector whose length has to be positive. So there's got to be some lambda where this linear combination has length squared 0. How do we calculate that lambda? What's the equation that determines it? Well, the equation that determines it is that the length squared of this vector is 0. So we take this vector, xi plus eta, xi plus lambda eta, and take the inner product using the metric with itself, and require that this is equal to 0. This is a quadratic equation. It's just a quadratic polynomial, really, in lambda. So f of lambda equal to 0 is a quadratic equation. Therefore, it has two roots. Let's call them lambda 1 and lambda 2. Are they real or are they complex? In general, they could also be complex. But we know that if one of them is real, the other one is also real, because the complex solutions, the complex roots always occur in pairs. So the lambdas that we can choose here to make this null are actually real. And the reason is, as we discussed before, that since xi is time-like, we have that f of 0 is smaller than 0. And since eta is space-like, we know that if we make lambda large enough, the whole thing becomes space-like, and therefore f of lambda goes positive. Therefore, we must have a zero crossing as we run through all possible values of lambda. So there has to be at least one real zero, and therefore the other one also has to be a real zero. So both roots are necessarily real numbers. Now, remember, we are assuming here that we know the causal structure of the manifold. We assume that we have an oracle that tells us, for any given tangent vector, whether or not it is null, or even whether it is the sign is positive or negative, the length of the length squared. But this means that we can run through all possible lambda values and then plug all of these vectors into the oracle, and the oracle will keep telling us, no, that's not zero length, until twice it will say, oh yeah, that's a zero length vector, we are on the light cone. And so the oracle actually gives us those two values, lambda 1 and lambda 2. Which means that for any given choice of xi and eta, we can use the oracle to find out two values of lambda, lambda 1 and lambda 2. Such that the linear combination is 0. So we can assume the lambda 1 and lambda 2 to be known, because we have the oracle, for any xi and eta. Now, so you see, even though the oracle gives us very crude information, it just tells us whether the length squared is positive, negative, or 0, or even it would be sufficient to just tell us when it is 0, it actually implies that we can extract real numbers out of it by just trying out through the lambda values and finding out when we get a 0. So we get this lambda 1 and lambda 2. Now, we prove the following lemma. The length squared of the xi vector divided by the length squared of the eta vector is actually the product of those two numbers, lambda 1 and lambda 2. That's an important lemma because it means that we can assume that this ratio is known. Because of the oracle, we can figure out for any vector xi and any time-like vector xi and any space-like vector eta, we can figure out what their ratio of the length squares is, namely it is lambda 1 and lambda 2, and we know that we can get the lambda 1, lambda 2 out of the oracle. Let's prove that. So we know that if we choose either lambda 1 or lambda 2 in the linear combination, then the length of this vector is 0, right? So if we choose lambda 1, this vector is light-like, and if we choose lambda 2, it's also light-like. So we get two equations that hold true. Namely, we get the equation that if we choose the lambda 1 here, we get that this is equal to 0 and spelled out, you know, xi plus lambda 1 eta, comma, xi plus lambda 1 eta. That gives us four terms. We get the xi xi term, then we get the two mixed terms, and then we get eta eta terms. And these are these two equations, one equation for lambda 1 and one equation for lambda 2. So we know that these two equations hold true. And both equations have the inner product of xi and eta in them. So we can solve these two equations. We can eliminate in these two equations this common expression. We solve one equation for that expression and then substitute it into the other. And when we do that, I leave it to you as a little exercise, we find that the claim is true. Namely that the length squared of the xi vector divided by the length squared of the eta vector is lambda 1, lambda 2. That's not quite yet what we want. We want to be able to calculate the inner product between any two vectors from just the oracle. But no, we can't do that yet, but we can calculate the ratio of the length squared of a light-like and the length squared of a space-like vector now. But knowing that, we can also conclude that we can calculate the ratios not only of the length squareds of a time-like and a space-like vector, but also of two time-like vectors, for example, and also of two space-like vectors. And here's how we can show that for two time-like vectors. So let's say we want to calculate what this ratio is, just on the basis of the oracle, where xi and xi prime are both time-like. Now, we know this ratio from the oracle, that's what we just proved in the lemma. If we choose another time-like vector xi prime, then we get lambda 1 prime and lambda 2 prime, but we can also calculate that ratio. But they have the g of eta eta in common. So we can solve one of those equations for g of eta eta, substitute it into the other, and we obtain the ratio of, of the length squared of two time-like vectors. And it is this, where these numbers, again, can be extracted from the oracle. Now we are almost done. Let us now consider two arbitrary non-null vectors. So let's say alpha is some time-like or space-like vector, and beta is some time-like or space-like vector. And we want to calculate their inner product using the metric. So we want to calculate what is g of alpha and beta. Well, g of alpha and beta can be written in this way. That's trivial. Why? Well, because g of alpha plus beta, comma alpha plus beta is really four terms. It's the alpha alpha term, it's the beta beta term, and it's two mixed terms here. So let's see what we have here. We have here g of alpha alpha with a minus sign, and here we have g of alpha alpha, so that cancels away. We also have a beta beta term with a minus sign. Here we have the g beta beta term, so that cancels away. So what do we have left here? Well, we have minus 2g of alpha comma beta. Minus 2g of alpha comma beta multiplied with minus 1 half. So we just have g of alpha comma beta, which is matching what's on the left-hand side. So we just rewrote g of alpha beta in a slightly more complicated way. The advantage of writing g of alpha comma beta in this way is that we've written it entirely in terms of evaluations of the metric with the same vector in both arguments. Alpha alpha, beta beta, alpha plus beta, alpha plus beta. See, that's useful because we know how to evaluate ratios of lengths when the two arguments are the same, whether they are space-like or time-like. So now, let's divide that entire equation by g of xi xi, where xi is some arbitrary vector whose length is not zero, because we don't want to divide by zero. So this equation then, by dividing by g of xi xi, where xi is some arbitrary tangent vector, becomes that equation. So here we have g of alpha beta, the desired quantity, the metric evaluating the inner product between any two tangent vectors. So we get this, the desired thing, divided by g of xi xi, is equal to each one of those terms divided by the g of xi xi. So on the left-hand side, we have almost what we are desiring, namely the inner product between any pair of arbitrary tangent vectors. And on the right-hand side, what do we have? We have ratios of length squares of time-like and space-like vectors. These ratios we can calculate from the oracle because they're just expressible in terms of lambda 1s and lambda 2s and lambda 1 primes and so on. So all these things on the right-hand side are explicit numbers that we can get from the oracle, just from knowing the causal structure, just from knowing where the light cones are, just from knowing which tangent vectors are null. We can put a number to this. And that means we get the inner product between the alpha and the beta explicitly. Except we only get it up to this denominator here. And if we choose our g to be some arbitrary space-like tangent vector field everywhere, then this is just some positive scalar prefactor. So what we obtain is the metric as a function of alpha and beta and some arbitrary scalar prefactor. So we can explicitly calculate that. So the conclusion is that if it is known which vectors are time-like, space-like, or null, then it is possible to calculate the metric g of alpha and beta at all points p for all tangent vectors alpha and beta up to a scalar prefactor. And that proves the theorem. Now, this means that the causal structure alone already determines the angles between vectors precisely, but not the lengths of these vectors, not the length squares of the tangent vectors. It determines them up to a positive scalar function. Some years ago, when I taught this course, I mentioned exactly these considerations there. And then two students came up after the lecture, and they said, oh, we'd like to look into this more closely. What can we do with this? And we ended up writing a paper on this. And I've been working on this ever since. It's really fascinating. What we did was this. We looked at quantum field theoretical propagators. I don't know if you've done quantum field theory yet, You know, I teach it next term. Quantum field theory for cosmology and black holes and so on. In quantum field theory, you consider so-called Feynman rules. They consist of propagators and vertices. The propagators describe how particles propagate freely, and then the vertices describe how they interact. The propagators of any kind of quantum field have the property that, I mean, first of all, they describe the probability distribution for if the particle is here now, what's the chance to find it over there later, roughly speaking. And it turns out that these propagators have the property that they diverge on the light cone. But what that means is that if you know the propagator of a quantum field theory, but you don't know the metric, so you only know the propagator of a quantum field theory on some space-time, well, then you have an oracle, because it means you can just check where does this thing blow up. And that tells you what are the null directions. So the propagators alone tell you the causal structure, and therefore, by this method, we did it differently, but it boils down to this, by this method, you can calculate what the metric is. So it's clear on one hand that the metric influences how matter is propagating on that space-time. But this shows that vice versa. If you only know how matter propagates, if you know the literal propagator.
The first thing is a propagator, like a Dirac observable.
Just a sec. Let's get back to that. Don't interrupt in the middle of the sentence, please. Right? So if you know how matter is propagating, then you have this oracle. So you can figure out where the light cones are, and therefore you can get the metric up to a scalar factor, except that the propagators have more information. They don't only tell you where the light cone is. The propagators are non-trivial functions, and we showed that you can get the scalar prefactor too. So you can get the metric completely from just knowing the propagators. And that's interesting because it means that not only can you view the metric as affecting the propagation of matter and the Feynman rules, but the Feynman rules already have built into them the complete information of about the metric. Now, I didn't mean to say that the propagator isn't observable, right? But the propagator goes into the calculation of any observable that you may want to measure. And therefore, you can determine, you know, where the light cones are. Yeah?
So is there an algorithmic approach to finding these, like, lambda roots? Like, you kind of described it as checking where it blows up. Or here you just said you check every lambda and
yes.
Find them. But
right. No, I'm afraid it's root finding.
Yeah.
It's root finding, but since it's only a quadratic polynomial, you have explicit formulas for that. So you can write down the explicit roots directly.
Okay.
You don't actually have to do a search.
Okay.
But also, if you calculate the metric from the propagator, there's also an explicit formula, and you don't even have to find roots. You just take the propagator, take it to an inverse power, and then differentiate it, and then take a coincidence limit and get the metric.
So in this case, where the angles are preserved and the metric is just being scaled by that function, can I say that I have a conformal killing vector field?
No. That would be an assumption
right.
On the manifold.
Right.
But this is true for all Lorentzian manifolds.
Okay.
For all of them. They don't need to have any particular symmetry.
So basically, you want to find the propagators through, like, for example, scattering amplitude and solve for the propagator, right?
For example, you could imagine that computers used to be as big as a house, and now they fit into the pocket. Now, an accelerator is as big as a city now, but maybe in the future they fit into a pocket. So you have your pocket accelerator, your pocket LHC. And in principle, you could go around and predict and measure. And when you make a prediction, you make assumptions about the local Feynman rules. If, for example, you happen to be traveling close to a black hole merger, there's significant curvature, your Feynman rules are going to be affected by this. But let's say for some reason you don't want to measure the metric, you don't want to measure the curvature, but instead all you care about is your pocket LHC. So what you do is you make assumptions about what your Feynman rules might be, what your propagator is, and so on, right? And then you check whether your predictions are right. And at some point, you get lucky and you guess the right propagator just by trial and error. It's experimentation, after all. So you experiment, you say, oh, okay, if I assume that my propagator function is this, then I make all the right predictions. But then you can take this propagator function and calculate the metric from it. Right? So you can experimentally, without performing any geometric measurements, you can experimentally determine which Feynman rules describe the situation correctly. And then you can use those Feynman rules and infer what the metric is without any clocks or rulers or anything of that kind. Which I think is cool because fundamentally we don't have clocks or rulers. They're always composites. And if you go to the subatomic scale, how do you build a ruler? Right? So that doesn't actually work anymore there at extremely small scales. But you can always measure Feynman rules because you can always try to make predictions for particle collisions and compare them to experiments. And therefore, you have a way of verifying, testing, refining your Feynman rules. And then from them, you can get the metric. I think that's important because Einstein's prescription for describing space-time was built on the idea that you have rods and clocks and you synchronize them and so on. None of this is possible at sufficiently small scales. You just can't build them physically. Okay, so if you want to read that paper, it's here on the archive. It was, of course, also published, but if you don't want to face the paywall, then on the archive it's here. So, implications are these. When two spacetimes described by a Lorentzian manifold with a metric G or a metric G tilde, so the same differentiable manifold but two different metrics on it, when these two metrics differ only by a positive scalar prefactor, then they possess the same causal structure. And what that means is that the set of all possible space-times can be decomposed into conformal equivalence classes. Because every space-time, and you might describe it by giving a differentiable manifold and a metric, is in this sense conformally equivalent to any other space-time that has the same differentiable manifold underlying, but it has a rescaled metric, where you just have some positive prefactor function there. We don't want it to go zero or negative, right? Because if it was zero, then the metric wouldn't be invertible. That doesn't fly in general relativity. And if you had it negative, then we would have a signature change. And that also we have no evidence for. So we consider for every space-time its conformal equivalence class, which is the set of all those space-times which can be described with the same metric except for a positive prefactor function. Remember, this is a space-time dependent function in general. Now that's useful conceptually, but it's also useful practically. And that's because it means that we can visualize things that would otherwise be very difficult to visualize. For example, if we wanted to visualize the causal structure of Minkowski space, then we could try to draw a diagram. But how big would it have to be? As big as Minkowski space, that's infinite. And that's messy. So what we can use here is the trick that we can do a trade-off here. If all we are interested in a space-time, is its causal structure, then we can take the space-time and multiply its metric with a suitable positive space-time dependent conformal prefactor such that all the distances, for example, shrink so much that even an infinite size space-time is shrunk into a finite size. Of course, it's two different space-times still. I'm not taking one and shrinking it. I didn't use the right word. I'm just saying that if you have an infinite size space-time like Minkowski space, then there is a conformally equivalent space-time that has only a finite size and that differs from the original infinite size space-time simply by some positive prefactor there. And the causal structure is exactly the same. So we can visualize infinite size stuff in a finite region. Let's keep in mind that there's a price to pay. What we use to visualize, and you know where this is going, is going towards Penrose diagrams. What we visualize is a conformally equivalent space-time. It's not the space-time that we were originally interested in. It's a conformally equivalent one. That is to say, that differs only by this positive prefactor function. And so it's not an isometry that connects those two space-times. It's a conformal transformation. The metrics are definitely not the same. But for considerations of causal structure, it doesn't matter because the angles are all the same. Okay, so here's the application then to Penrose diagrams. Let's consider, for example, Minkowski space in spherical coordinates, spatially spherical coordinates. So what do we have? We have here dx0, dx0, or minus dx0, dx0. We can also write this as minus dt, dt. And then we have either Cartesian coordinates, or we have the spherical coordinates, dr dr, r squared d theta d theta, plus r squared sine squared theta d theta d phi d phi. Now, in these spherical coordinates, remember this is just ordinary Minkowski space, right? But we write it in spherical coordinates. We have that the time axis runs from minus infinity to plus infinity. Then r is a radius, so it runs only from 0 to plus infinity. And then phi is an angle that goes around the equator. It's 2 pi. And theta goes from the south pole to the north pole, so this goes only 180 degrees, so pi. Now, that would be hard to visualize, right, because of the range of r and t. But we can now consider a space-time which is not isometric, but it's conformally equivalent. And that space-time is given by the metric g bar with dt bar and dr bar and so on. But the thetas and the phi we leave untouched. They are running only through finite intervals anyway. And these two space-times with variables t and r, or t bar and r bar, are related by a diffeomorphism. So there is a coordinate transformation that gets you from the one to the other. And this diffeomorphism is not an isometry, but it is conformal. Namely, the two metrics are related by this factor phi. And it's this expression. It's all very complicated, and there's no point in going into the details of this. But you can look that up in the literature. So these two manifolds have, therefore, the same causal structure because their metrics ultimately just differ by a scalar prefactor there. And can you imagine how tedious it is to work that out, right? Because you have to express the dt bars in terms of the dts and the dr bars in terms of the drs and so on and so on. The point is that, why do we go through the trouble of finding this new conformally equivalent space-time? Well, we go through the trouble because in the new variables, under this diffeomorphism, We have that t bar plus r bar ranges only from minus pi to pi, and also t bar minus r bar ranges only from minus pi to pi, and then the r bar is positive, it's a radius. We can call this variable u, we call this variable v, and then what we have is a cube, obviously, right? From minus pi to pi and from minus pi to pi. But that's a cube in u and in r. And if you remember, maybe you've seen this before, if you have u is equal to a plus b and v is equal to a minus b, this is a cube that's rotated by 45 degrees. So what we have, therefore, is that the entire Minkowski space is now shrunken here to a finite size where the t-bars and the r-bars have only a finite range. And it's this half of a cube. You see, this ought to be a cube if it wasn't for r-bar larger than 0. R-bar is the new radius. So here's the radial variable, r-bar. If we allowed it to be negative, we would have a complete cube here. But we don't allow it to be negative because it's still the radius. And the time variable t bar goes upwards. So all of Minkowski space is mapped into this half cube from here to here. It's mapped into this half cube, keeping the angles between any two tangent vectors the same. Right? That's the whole point of doing this conformal transformation. So for example, we can pick a point in here and draw the angles of the forward and backward light cones, and they're going to be at 45 degrees. How do we know that? Well, because they were in Minkowski space there, right? And so here too, because it's a conformal transformation. So how to navigate a picture like this, the Penrose diagram of Minkowski space? First of all, some notation here. If we have a continuous green line like these here, they describe infinities. And I'll say in a moment what kind. And then a dotted green line, that's this one, that's always the radius equal to 0. Radius equal to 0, so you're sitting at the origin of the coordinate system, and you're just traveling forward in time. That's the world line of somebody sitting at radius equal to 0. There's no singularity in this, because there's no singularity in Minkowski space, but later on we will also draw singularities, and they will have double lines. They're indicated by double lines. You have a question?
Yeah, sorry. Okay, so the fact that they have different signatures isn't a problem. You can still be conformally.
What do you mean by signature?
It's like the g is negative dt squared and the g bar is positive dt squared.
Oh, no, that's a typo.
Oh, okay, good.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thanks, I'll fix this. Okay, so. So what do we have here? Let's say you're sitting at the origin of the coordinate system at r equal to 0, and you just keep sitting there. Then you come from minus infinity, time minus infinity, the infinite past. You sit there at r equal to 0. You know, we are not plotting the angles here. You're sitting here at r equal to 0, and you just keep going until future infinity. Now, past infinity is I minus, and future infinity is I plus. But I should specify, that's the past infinity for someone who always travels in a time-like fashion, has always traveled in a time-like fashion, and will always travel in a time-like fashion. This is important. I'll tell you in a moment why. So anybody who has always traveled less than the speed of light and has had no ambition to reach the speed of light, always starts here. So And then they might travel around, so they don't stay at r equal to 0. So they go somewhere here. Or you might even not start at r equal to 0. If you started at r equal to a million miles away, you'd still, all of this would be compressed into that point here. And then you travel, and you end up over there again. This is a little confusing, perhaps, that all of space in past time-like infinity is compressed to that point down there. And you may wonder, what about this then? What about that here? We'll get to that in this picture in a moment. Let me just tell you that different radius is going from r equal to 0 further out, and being infinitely far away from the origin of the coordinate system only gets you this far. That's infinitely far away. That's I0. That's space-like infinity. Space-like infinity is compressed here all the way that way. Remember, this isn't Minkowski space. That's just a space-time that is conformally equivalent to it, right? We just shrunk everything. All right, so if, okay, and then the time variable goes like this, and it's the t bar variable that goes like that. The actual original time variable goes like this. This is a surface of equal time. That's a surface of equal time. That's a surface of equal time. That's a surface of equal time. So all the events of Minkowski space are in here. Now you may wonder, what about this line here and that line there? How could I get there? Who gets there? Well, imagine this event here, somewhere here in Minkowski space. And I'm sending out a beam of light with a laser pointer. Since I'm neglecting the angles here, I have only two choices. I can shoot the laser beam towards the origin, r equals 0, or I can shoot it away from the origin, inward or outward. And let's say I shoot it outward. In that case, there would be a laser beam that starts here and then goes at 45 degrees, because it's a conformal transformation, goes in 45 degrees. And so that laser beam is going to hit that line, called script I plus or scribe plus. So I'm going to hit that line. So all the laser beams, all the light that's emitted in the direction of increasing r will hit this scribe plus surface at some point. Light that came traveling from past infinity, but was light all the time, came from scribe minus. So let's look at that in examples. That's the next picture. So here's the same plot, but I just didn't plot the t equal constant lines anymore. So R1, R2, R3, R4 are just observers that traveled from arbitrary locations, not necessarily r equal to 0. Remember that all of space is contracted to this point down here. But if you just go a little bit up here, right, then then you can differentiate those points. So observers that are just sitting there and are not changing their radius, just sitting there inertially and at rest actually in that coordinate system, they travel on these world lines. So they just acquire age. They just get older, right? And so these are just observers sitting there. These are these four lines, R1 to R4. But imagine there is another one of them who finds things to get a little boring sitting around for an infinity amount of time, right? And so that observer at this point decides, I'm going to accelerate. I'm going to accelerate, let's say, uniformly. So I just keep accelerating forever at some acceleration. Doesn't matter which acceleration it is. But of course, towards the speed of light, because this fellow has an infinite amount of time and is always accelerating towards the speed of light. And that means that the angle becomes closer and closer to 45 degrees. And in this way, this observer is not going to end up over here at I plus, at future time like infinity. No, that observer is going to end up at future light like infinity. That is scribe plus. And similarly, an observer could have come from scribe minus, but that means in the past, that observer must have been arbitrarily close to the speed of light. The further you go back in time, the closer that observer must have been to the speed of light. And the observer has been decelerating ever since. That would be an observer that comes here from 45 degrees and then levels up like that and so on. Now we are ready to define what is meant by an observer's event horizon. And that's what we see here too, is that there is no such thing as the event horizon. It's always the event horizon of somebody. So when do we say that an observer has an event horizon? What would that be? Well, let's look at the example of this observer who was bored and then started accelerating forever, and therefore hits scribe plus. That observer has what is called an event horizon. So here's our observer again, the one that was sitting there inertially and then started accelerating and then eventually is approaching scribe plus. This observer has an event horizon in the following sense. Any event that happens up here, our observer will never learn about. It's like you're traveling with a ship on the ocean and something is happening beyond your horizon, you won't see it. And so this observer will never see what happens over here. And that's because any event of here has a future light cone that goes like this, and there's no way that anything could propagate there. Even if something is sitting here, it cannot message our observer anymore. But how do we describe that technically? We need to have a description of this that doesn't require finger pointing. There's got to be something more sophisticated than this. So intuitively, the event horizon is the boundary that separates the events that can communicate to our, that can influence our observer, and the events that cannot influence our observer. It's the boundary of all those events, of the set of all those events that our observer can learn about. So in other words, it's the boundary of the past of that observer. See, for that observer, what is in the past, what is in that observer's past, in the sense that the set of events that could have influenced that observer. So for that, the technical term is that we take our observer, and we look at that observer's causal future infinity. So this observer is taken towards the conclusion of where this observer goes, like in this case, scribe plus. And then the past of that is the set of all those events, the causal past of that is the set of all those events that could have influenced this. It's a generalization of the term past light cone. Right? So in Minkowski space, it's just a past light cone. In this case, it is just that. But it can be more complicated than that. So let's just say it's the past of that observer, the causal past. And remember what the word causal here means? It means connected either light-like or null, but not space-like, because that couldn't affect him. Okay, so we say that an observer's event horizon, if the observer has an event horizon, is the boundary of the past of this observer's future causal infinity. So wherever that observer goes in the future, we consider the past of that and then the boundary of that. That boundary is the event horizon. If, for example, that observer was to decide to give up on the acceleration business for lack of fuel, every observer will come to that conclusion, what will happen is that they no longer end up at Scribe Plus. But instead, they sharply turn around and they end up at I Plus. Right? Because all the observers that are inertial will follow a trajectory like this. No matter how close you are there, if you switch off the engine, whoop, you go this way. You go to I plus. And then your future causal infinity becomes I plus, whose past is entire Minkowski space. And therefore, there is nothing outside that you are missing. Therefore, this is not a horizon for you. Right? So the boundary of your past is only an event horizon if it's a boundary beyond which there is something that you don't see. But it's all of Minkowski space, so then this observer has no event horizon. I think this is an important point because often it is said that in the Andrew effect, the Andrew uniformly forever accelerated observer has an event horizon. There is no such thing in nature. Cannot be, because you would need an insane amount of energy to keep accelerating at the constant rate. This observer would become extremely heavy. And from the perspective of those who don't accelerate with that observer, and that observer would tear through space-time and change it. So therefore, the Andrew effect, of course, I think, should not be calculated on the basis of the assumption that there's a horizon, because there cannot be a horizon. Anybody who tries to accelerate forever will not succeed and become like those guys and then not have a horizon. I think the Andrew effect is very real, but it doesn't rely on having a horizon. Okay, so now let's go to non-trivial spacetimes, like a Friedmann-Lemaître spacetime of cosmology. Let's keep k equal to zero, so spatially flat. Spacetime is flat spatially. The only non-trivial part is the expansion. So now we might expect that things look very different, completely different Penrose diagram. Or is it? Well, here is the Friedmann-Lemaître metric. And you notice that it has a scale factor in front of the radial part and in front of the angular part here. What this means is that here we have chosen a coordinate system in which r is what is called a co-moving radius. It's very important for later. For example, let's say you had a map of the universe. And there is, in the middle, there is, for example, our galaxy. And then you see Andromeda somewhere. And then you see another galaxy, and other galaxies, and so on, right? Far away galaxies. And you have that map. And let's say you have all the time in the world, literally billions of years. Now, you could say, well, OK, so every few hundred million years, I should update my map because these galaxies drift further away from another. But then it's entirely predictable that the universe is just expanding. So why would you do that? So what you do instead is you keep your map and you say that the distance from here to a galaxy so-and-so is this much, and so on. And you keep the map the same, and you just say that I choose a coordinate system which grows with the universe. So that numerically, the distances to all the other galaxies stay the same in that co-moving coordinate system, a coordinate system that grows with the universe. Of course, if I wanted to travel to these galaxies, I would then have to go to the actual distances, the physical distances from the co-moving distances. And this is a choice of coordinate system like that. The R is a co-moving coordinate system. So a galaxy, another galaxy would always have, in this coordinate system, it would always have the same numerical distance r from us. But the actual physical distance is calculated using the metric, and there's an a in there. And that takes care of the fact that the universe is expanding. So we have here this co-moving coordinate system. Time is ordinary cosmic time as measured by a co-moving observer, just like the clock on your phone in your pocket here. That would be a good approximation for cosmic time. But now we change to a new time variable, tau, the so-called conformal time. And we make this clever choice of change of variable here. Instead of using the time variable t, we use the time variable tau, the conformal time. And it's obtained by this integral, integral 1 over a, 1 over the scale factor. Why would we want to do that? Well, let's differentiate this equation, and we get that d tau by dt is equal to 1 over a, which means that dt is a times d tau, which means that if we substitute that over here, then every dt becomes an a d tau, which means we get an a squared d tau here. And what that means is that in this new coordinate system with the conformal time, the Friedmann-Lemaître cosmological space-time takes the form of a squared multiplying this. You see, because now we don't only have an a squared here and there, we have it also here, which means that the Friedmann-Lemaître metric is, up to a scale factor, the Minkowski space metric. That's a conformal prefactor here. So what we just showed is that the Friedmann-Lemaître cosmological space-times are conformally equivalent to Minkowski space. They are not Minkowski space, but they have the same causal structure, and they differ. All the angles are the same, etc. It's just scaling that makes a difference here. And that means we can reuse the same Penrose diagrams. But something's got to change, right? And what can change is the range of the Penrose diagram. That can change. And as we will see, it does. So the Penrose diagrams of Friedmann-Lemaître cosmologies for k equal to 0, so no spatial curvature, it would just make things a bit more complicated. So let's do a concrete example, a radiation-dominated universe. So the scale factor, if you remember from the previous lecture, is going then like the square root of t. At t equal to 0, we have the Big Bang, and then the scale factor goes like a square root. What is the conformal time in this case? Well, we calculate it, and we obtain that the conformal time is 2 times the square root of the cosmic time. So the conformal time, tau, is always positive, because the cosmic time is always positive. It starts with the Big Bang, and then it's positive, which means we get the same picture as above, but it starts at t equal to 0. All of that is gone because of the Big Bang. All right, so what we have now is a picture just like Minkowski space, but here now we have a double line indicating the presence of a singularity. This is a universe that's always radiation dominated, right? So it starts radiation dominated, it's always radiation dominated, then that's the picture that we get here. Again, we have a scribe plus. Here's our observer that accelerates forever, hypothetically, and then here's an observer who just travels back and forth and eventually, but never trying to reach the speed of light, and then it reaches future time-like infinity. We can also consider here some event P and look at its past light cone. And we notice that its past light cone, which contains all the events that could have possibly influenced it, is just a finite chunk here, which means that an observer who sits here cannot have learned anything about what happened over there or over here. There just hasn't been enough time yet for the signal to travel over there. Of course, this observer might travel onwards like this, and then the observer's past light cone would be like that and would learn more, right? the distance that the observer who sits at this event P can look back is called the particle horizon. That's not an event horizon. It's the particle horizon. It's how far someone can look back. And we have a particle horizon, for example, and we will calculate it in a moment. So, particle horizon, for every, how far away is the particle horizon at some time t, for example? Well, remember, this is the metric here. And it's not the conformal time. I'm using now the cosmic time for convenience. We have the trajectory of a light ray that an observer is sending out, and we want to know, you know, how far away is this? How much distance away can this observer look? Remember, again, r is co-moving distance, not physical distance, co-moving distance. It needs to be multiplied by a in order to get the physical distance. So this is the trajectory of a light beam. No particular angles. It starts at r equal to 0 and then travels in some direction at the speed of light. Gamma naught is the time coordinate. Gamma 1 is the radial coordinate. We have that it's traveling light-like, which means that the tangent vector must have length equal to 0. See, we don't need to solve the geodesic equation. We just know the tangent vector has to have length 0. That's this equation here. And if we write for gamma naught t and gamma 1 r, then we obtain this equation here. You know, we can have an outgo, I mean, for we can have light rays that increase the radius and light rays that decrease the radius. And what we obtain here is that the light rays have dr by dt, the speed of light, is plus minus, namely plus or minus because it's either increasing the radius or it's going in the other direction, decreasing the radius. The speed of light is 1 over a of t. Huh. Speed of light is changing? That can't be right. It's right. It's just that r is not the physical distance. R is the co-moving distance. Right? And as the universe is expanding, it becomes harder and harder to cross co-moving distance, because co-moving distance means more and more physical distance. So as the universe is expanding, the speed of light in terms of the co-moving coordinates drops. And now we can calculate how far a light beam can have possibly traveled over a certain amount of cosmic time. For that, we just integrate up the speed of light, and we obtain this integral. And for example, for us today, if you perform that integral with the best of our knowledge for a of t, we find that it is around 40 billion light years. Anything that's further away than 40 billion light years, we cannot have seen yet because the universe is not old enough. You might think, why is it not 13.8 billion light years away? Well, it's because the universe expanded since. Okay, so now let's remember what an event horizon is. An observer's event horizon is the boundary of the past of this observer's future infinity. So if we have what is called the cosmological event horizon, then this is nothing but the particle horizon that we will have if we travel forever. In other words, we can ask, at the moment we have a particle horizon of about 40 billion light years away. But we expect that as we age, that particle horizon is increasing by one light year per year, roughly. The universe is also expanding, so it's a bit more than that. But the question is, if we give ourselves an infinite amount of time, will we see eventually all of the universe? Or are there parts of the universe that are so far away that they will remain forever hidden from us? Because even light cannot travel fast enough to us, because space is expanding more between us and them per year than light can cross per year. If so, then we have an infinite, then we have a finite particle horizon, and therefore we have a cosmological event horizon. And everybody then has a cosmological event horizon. And the question whether or not we have a cosmological event horizon is the question of whether the particle horizon distance is finite or infinite as we age towards infinity. As we go to future infinity, will our particle horizon be finite or infinite? See, obviously, as we wait an infinite amount of time, we can look infinitely far back. I mean, infinitely far back, infinitely far out. But we have to be super careful because that doesn't guarantee that we see all of it. We have to check whether the co-moving distance that we can see is actually infinite. It could be that we can see only a finite co-moving distance, and anything that's further out we can't see. And you know, we're calculating here co-moving distances. So co-moving distance is, if you remember, calculated in this way. So we have to integrate 1 over a. But now we're integrating it up all the way to future infinity. And then the question is, for example, for a Friedmann-Lemaître universe, the question is whether that integral here is finite or infinite. If it is infinite, great. We will eventually see all co-moving distances. So we will eventually get signals from all galaxies. If it's finite, though, then on our map of the universe, where every galaxy has a fixed co-moving distance, we can only see so many galaxies out. Now, W here is the famous W parameter, the ratio of pressure over energy density. And for a radiation-dominated universe, that's a third. For an inflationary universe, it would be like minus a third, at least. Right? Because remember from the previous lecture, it has to be at least minus a third. OK, and so what we find here is that this is convergent, and therefore we have a cosmological event horizon exactly if W is smaller than minus a third, which is exactly also the condition, if you remember, for having inflation, for having an acceleration of the scale factor. So if and only if the W parameter is such that we have an accelerated expansion, then we have a cosmological horizon. By the way, just a little comment here. Oh my God, I'm running out of time. And just a little comment here. The event horizon, the particle horizon distance, is this integral. And if you remember, that was also the integral that we used to calculate the conformal time. So the conformal time tells us also automatically how far we can see. And therefore, if the conformal time ends up finite, that's exactly the same as saying that we have a cosmological horizon. So if inflation is happening, then the Penrose diagram is truncated above the tau equal to tau max time line. And that looks in the following way. So this is the, just to remind you, a Friedmann-Lemaître space-time with a Big Bang and no inflation in the future. For example, radiation-dominated universe would have this Penrose diagram. And in this case, if you're traveling over there, so you're not trying to do the Unruh effect, you're not accelerating forever, then you arrive at future time like infinity, and the past is all of that space-time, and the boundary of it has nothing beyond it, so you don't have a cosmological event horizon. However, with inflation, it looks different because now you have that truncated here. It's no longer going like this, but it's truncated like that. With inflation, you can have observers who travel happily there and so on, but their past light cone is not overlapping with, for example, this observer's past light cone. And so there can be observers who will never ever learn anything about each other. That could never happen in this case because that's just a 45-degree line. So, you know, that, and then from here, that, you know, they always overlap. Now, being completely out of time, very quickly, this is really a pity, black holes that you have to do in pity, but we come back to black holes again. Okay, so let's say we have a Schwarzschild black hole. Here is the metric of the Schwarzschild black hole. And it seems to have a singularity here at r equal to the so-called Schwarzschild radius, but that's just a coordinate singularity. There are other coordinate systems, such as a Kruskal coordinate system, which show that there is no singularity at all there. Everything is fine. Now, can we draw a Penrose diagram for it? Now, that's quite non-trivial. However, it turns out that whenever we have a space-time of any number of dimensions, we can always grab two dimensions of that and hold things fixed for the other two dimensions. And then for these two dimensions that we consider, we can use the fact that any two-dimensional space-time is always conformally equivalent to two-dimensional Minkowski space. And why would that be? Well, it's because if you take the metric of any two-dimensional Lorentzian manifold or submanifold, remember sometimes you have to cut pieces away because of singularity, for example, then in suitable coordinates, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, every metric is of the form of conformal factor times eta mu nu. You may wonder why. Why is it always conformally equivalent in two dimensions to Minkowski space of two dimensions? Well, the reason is that in two dimensions, the metric is a 2x2 matrix, which has three non-trivial components, because it's symmetric, right? It has three non-trivial components. But by choice of coordinate system, you get to choose two arbitrary functions, namely the new time coordinate, the new space coordinate, two arbitrary functions, which you can use to manipulate the metric tensor, for example, such that out of these three parameters that it has, two are fixed the way you want. And what that means is that you can actually make it such that the remaining parameter that's not fixed by the choice of coordinate system is just a conformal prefactor. For that reason, if we drop the angular part of the Schwarzschild metric and just consider R and T, then there is a way, because there has to be a way, in which it can be seen as conformally equivalent to Minkowski space, or at least a part of it. And these transformations have been found. And you can look it up, for example, in the text by Susskind and Lindsay. And we will later get back to that too. And we obtain then that this is how it looks. So it's just like Minkowski space, except there is a singularity up here, and then every time-like traveling observer, that is, every observer that ends up at I plus, only those who are traveling at speed of light or approaching it end up on scribe plus. all of these observers that end up at I plus have as their past all of this, right? They have as their past all of this. And the boundary of that is this event horizon. And everything that's in here is what we call inside the black hole. So, for example, all the matter particles that make up a star that collapses could start like this, and then the star collapses like that, disappears behind the horizon. And then we have two travelers, a wise traveler and an unwise traveler. The wise traveler knows better than going into the black hole. And the unwise traveler actually makes it into the black hole and into the singularity. The black hole may eventually also radiate away. And if it does, then you get another copy of Minkowski space just sitting on top of it. This looks small, but it's conformal, right? So this is an entire fresh Minkowski space that's sitting then on top of that. So here we have Hawking radiation diminishing the black hole, and then that's how that happens.